Hello, podcast listeners. This is your host, Ryan Van Wyk, back with another episode of Ryan PR's podcast. I'm so happy. I said yesterday, my tripod for my, they basically set my phone down so I could record videos better. Came in yesterday. I was, like, so excited about that. I was waiting for that for, like, a 3 to 4 days, maybe, and it finally came in. So now I got something, to do. Then I got a new tablet the other day, 10-inch screen, better than the one that I had before. The last one I had was a 7-inch screen, this is a 10, and I've been playing on it for the last couple of days, so it's keeping me entertained, and since I just got off of work at Meijer at 3, me and my mom stopped and got dinner, it basically comes with a decent amount of fries, but I got something called a rib-tip dinner from this restaurant called PJ's. They're known for, like, getting, like, you can get Philly steaks there, you can get Italian beef there, fish, barbecue tips, which is what I got. So, that's pretty good, and then I got another book. I forget what the fuck I did with it, but there's a book I got yesterday. Oh, it's called Where the Tour Buses Don't Go. It's a book that I got that was with my tripod yesterday. And then I also got my movie called Leprechaun Returns. And what I hated, though, and I didn't realize it, is that when I had bought the Leprechaun series and I was visiting my brother, I only knew about 7 movies. I didn't know about an 8th one. And it kind of throws everybody off, because for anybody who saw the Leprechaun movies, the first movie, it starred Jennifer Aniston when she was really young. And then the second, third, fourth, fifth, and the second through the seventh movie skip over the first one. The eighth one is a direct sequel to the first, which is fucking stupid. So anyway, but even though I got the movie yesterday, it completes the set. Now I'm waiting on my Prince Caspian film, which completes the set of Chronicles of Narnia that they filmed. So now the Prince Caspian's the next one I'm waiting on. Of course, I changed my name on my podcast last week to Ryan to RBW King, and it's a takeoff of and the RBW King is a takeoff of my first name, the R's for my first name, the BW for my last name, and the King is in reference to my actual full given name. Basically, Ryan in Irish means King, so basically that's where the King comes in at. And then my mom's accessories for her wheelchair came in, and we're looking for and I think she's still waiting on the wheelchair itself. Hold on a second. Fucking watch. God damn, my fucking fat ass mother bellin' me already. She always does this shit. I can't remember what the hell I was watching yesterday when I went to bed. Oh, it might have been Casino. One of the oldest movies that's ever been made, and actually one of the good movies. And the Cubs were able to, the Cubs were able to take 3 out of 4 games against the Nationals, and the Cubs won yesterday 5-2. Ian Happ, who's been struggling, actually hit 2 home runs yesterday, which actually, hopefully that's a sign that shows he might be coming out of a slump. And then I was looking at something yesterday. Obviously my mom sent me a link for it. There's, something, and I know my Roku stick has it. It's called FUBU. It's almost like a cable thing. It's either called FUBO TV or FUBU. Here, let me see this for a minute. I know my TV has it for like the Roku, and you could, And it's similar to cable, but it's not cable. Basically, you get it for a cheaper price, and you can basically watch all your shows on this thing without having to have cable. And it's something that we're looking into. It says basically you could do it for like a month, but I don't know if I want to do it for a month yet. That's something I have to look into. Let's check my tweets here. I can't remember exactly how many tweets I'm up to. Let's see what we got here. I don't have that many followers on Twitter. But I am up to 3,812 tweets. That's a pretty decent amount. And I've only had my Twitter account since December of last year. Most of my tweets are to the Overnight Drive podcast, or sometimes I respond to them. And I gained kind of a following with them. Basically, I'm like a correspondent to their channel, so basically I've kind of basically bec like everybody knows me on the channel now. No, oh crap. I saw this story. Now, let's see. I've never been to Bank of America and never had them as a bank, but this is a rumor of what they're going to do for the employees. Bank of America had announced on Tuesday that it would be raising its minimum wage to $25 an hour by the year 2025, and it would now require its U.S. vendors to pay employees at least $15 an hour. Bank of America's increase to paying $25 per hour builds on the company's history of being an industry leader in establishing a minimum rate of pay for its U.S. hourly employees. Since 2010, the minimum hourly wage will have increased by more than 121%, the company said in a press release. The banking giant noted that in March of last year it had raised its minimum wage to $20 an hour, which was 1 year ahead of schedule. According to Bank of America, more than 99% of its U.S. vendors currently earn at least $15 an hour because of its wage policies. A core tenet of responsible growth is our commitment to being a great place to work, which means investing in the people who serve the clients, said Sherry Bronstein, who's the Chief Human Resources Officer at Bank of America. That includes providing strong pay and competitive benefits to help them and their families so that we continue to attract and retain the best talent. Bank of America's announcement comes as the renewed calls for raising the minimum wage have risen. During his first joint address to Congress, Biden had called for a $15 an hour minimum wage, federal-wise. The guys and women on Wall Street didn't build this country. The middle class built this country, and unions build the middle class, Biden said during his address. And that's why I'm calling on Congress to pass the Protect the Right to Organize Act, the PRO Act, and send it to my desk to support the right to unionize. And by the way, while you're thinking about sending things to my desk, let's raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, which it should have been. Hold on to a second here. CEOs should put their should put the the CEOs should put the employees where their where their mouths are. Basically, I don't know what exactly that means. It is clear now that many states are following what Georgia did in passing the voter suppression laws. Florida just enacted such a law, so have Iowa and Texas, and it's not far behind. Several other states have already passed or they are in the process of considering laws that are clearly targeted at diminishing voter participation by minority voters in other urban constituencies. As some observers are now pointing out, certain enhancements to voter access, such as absentee balloting, are in fact they're highly used by Republican voters as well. But nonetheless, the Republican Party apparatus is undeterred in their efforts to undermine the broader voter participation. And there was what they call there was a very widespread CEO outcry in reaction to the Georgia law, and the large part catalyzed by the incredible efforts of Jeffrey Sonnenfeld of Yale. However, the Republicans have strenuously pushed back against the CEO reaction, and the force of corporate activity in other states since then has diminished, although some major corporations have been active behind the scenes working to remove the worst elements of these bills. And while the broader array of the nation's chief executives who weighed in on the issue did so very much in a spirit of bipartisanship, it has become very apparent that the Republican reaction at both the federal and state level is such that there is very little hope that voting rights is going to become a bipartisan issue anytime soon. In order to undo the effects of these state laws, it is also very apparent that federal legislation is necessary even if it is focused solely on voting rights and the anti-election steal provisions, meaning the significant issue of not allowing state legislators to insert themselves into local vote counting or overturning the legitimate election results. However, based on the diminished momentum we are seeing from the CEO foray, it is highly doubtful that the CEO community will unite around an attempt to push a voter protection law through the Senate by overturning the filibuster rule as an answer to the big lie. It has also become very clear that rather than the ability to have a reasonable debate about voter laws, the Republican Party has now firmly established a litmus test that unless you embrace the big lie and the notion that the election was stolen, you're no longer welcome as a Republican. Just look at Liz Cheney being stripped of her House leadership position. The big lie has become the rationale underlying all these voter suppression efforts, and the Republican position on that issue has only hardened over the last month. Just see the reception that Mitt Romney got from his own Utah Republican convention. The Republican Party has become one centered on the complete devotion to Trumpian fabrications. The threat of withholding campaign contributions to the scores of Republican congressmen and senators who voted to deny the legitimacy of Joe Biden's victory has obviously not had much deterrent effect. In fact, the most successful grassroots fundraising has been those Republicans on the extreme who have most championed the big lie and Donald Trump's defiant words. The CEOs could, of course, pull events out of the states that enact laws driven by the big lie, but there is hardly a better example of such action than the Major League Baseball pulling the All-Star game out of Atlanta, which has not seemed to have any effect on the actions of Florida or Texas. The moreover, local Democrats spoke out against those actions that as hurting the very people that those events would otherwise financially support. The inverse of this, although it was not done because of the voter issues, is Apple deciding to build an enormous $1 billion campus in North Carolina, a key swing state, which will presumably bring thousands of young and diverse workers to that state. And however, that kind of action in and of itself is not scalable enough to truly change the demographics of most swing states. And what can the corporate community do from here if it is truly committed to living up to its words of support for Ken Chenault and Ken Frazier, two of the most prominent black CEOs in the country, whose articulation of this issue excellently captured its importance to both American business and American democracy? But there is something corporate America could do that does not involve having to take Republicans head on in a legislative battle over the filibuster or to undermine pro-voting rights in local Democratic politicians who do not want to see their states robbed of commercial activity because of a boycott. But we have learned something from the pandemic that would be critical to solving this issue. We have not only learned from the pandemic that in the political arena, an election can be conducted with great integrity based on constructive rules around absentee ballots, drop boxes, and early voting, but also learned in the corporate arena that the vast majority of employees in offices and office jobs can work remotely without ever having to set foot in their corporate offices. There are some 24 million United States employees of the S&P 500 companies alone, some significant portion of which could easily work from residence far from their previous corporate location, as many have over the last 14 months. In fact, many employees would potentially welcome the opportunity to move to states with better weather, lower taxes, and lower cost of living overall, whether that be states like Georgia, Florida, Texas, Arizona, or North Carolina. Many others would certainly respond to financial incentives to move to such locations if their companies offered them. Essentially, I am proposing creating a corporate initiative to turn demography into a political destiny for the key swing states. Now, if corporate America decided that it would support a new corporate migration, the swing states of women, young and diverse employees, and those most likely to vote against the big lie candidates, especially when we were talking about the very thin voter margins for Biden that we saw in Georgia, Arizona, and Wisconsin. Admittedly, it was not a good weather state. This could reshape the voter demography of those states in a short period of time. Looking at history, the two great migrations of African Americans from the South to northern states certainly reshaped the demography of many states. Not sure if I'm saying that word right. Moreover, rather than many of these corporations having limited political clout in the most important swing states, and mass migration of employees to those states would enhance corporate political capital in those very areas. And very importantly, the new census will involve a net swing of 8 additional electoral votes to states that Trump won. And so the demography of population distribution is not working in the favor of blue state America, thus defeating Trumpism through an influx of new voters to key swing states with an eye toward the 2020 and 2024 elections. It would be extremely well-timed to counter these already baked-in population shifts. And then it goes on and on and on. I'm not going to read that whole thing. Let's try this here. Okay. Now, Trump couldn't steal the election in 2020, but his allies are sure trying to lay the groundwork for 2024. Donald Trump's campaign to steal the 2020 election after clearly losing at the ballot box failed for a couple reasons. Hold on a second here. Gotta do one more thing, Tom. It's so fucking hot out, I'm fucking sweating like crazy. Donald Trump's baseless claims of fraud were thrown out by virtually every court that heard them because basically he had no evidence. Perhaps most important, many GOP officials refused to play along, including Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, who declined to find 11,780 votes that Donald Trump was claiming that he needed to win that state, and then the vice squatter Mike Pence, who turned down a demand from the squatter himself that he blocked Joe Biden's victory from being certified by Congress. But the former squatter and his allies aren't done. Pro Trump sycophants in dozens of states are now looking to change election laws to make it harder for the Democrats to win, would make it easier for Republicans to challenge the results if their candidate loses. If they're successful, the chaotic aftermath of the 2020 election may have only been a rehearsal for a second round in 2024. What was really scary about 2020 was how close we came to a meltdown. Edward Foley, who's an election law expert at Ohio University, has said, "It's not too early to worry about a January 6, 2025. One part of the GOP election law campaign has gotten plenty of publicity. New laws in Georgia and elsewhere to make voting more difficult, including a statute that makes it criminal offense to get people water while they fucking wait in line, which is pathetic. But other less visible actions may be more important. In at least 36 different states, Republican legislators have proposed laws to weaken the autonomy of local election officials and put more power over the vote counting in the hands of legislators. There's a recipe for political meddling and election results, but it's the opposite of what good election administration should be." This is what Jocelyn Benson, who's a Michigan's Democratic Secretary of State, had said. In Georgia, for example, the same law that criminalized people giving water to thirsty voters also gave the legislator the right to appoint the chair of the state election board and gave the board the right to take over a country's election management. That's the most destabilizing thing. The most destabilizing thing is the effort to change who is in charge of the vote counting process, Foley said, but that's really dangerous. The most important battle over the ground rules for the 2024 presidential election will happen in plain sight with the 2022 election of governors, secretaries of state, and the state legislators, plus members of the U.S. House of Representatives. To understand why those jobs matter for the 2024 presidential election requires a brief refresher on the very creaky machinery of the Electoral College, which the Electoral College is a fucking joke. They need to abolish that. The Constitution gives every state legislator the power to regulate the elections that produce the electoral votes in advance of Election Day. The legislators write the rules, and then each state secretary of state administers the election, and they oversee the vote count. But once the votes are tallied, it's up to the governor to certify the Electoral College result and send it back to Congress, and Congress counts the electoral votes, and they confirm the result. In most election years, that process is uncontroversial, but when a losing candidate contests the election, it can turn into a thicket of ill-defined powers. Last year, for example, Trump asked several GOP governors to refuse to certify their state's results, under the legal theory that if the electoral votes for Biden weren't certified, they couldn't be counted. But when Georgia Governor Brian Kemp refused, Trump called him the worst than a Democrat and threatened him with a primary challenge. Next step, if no candidate has a majority of the certified electoral votes, then it falls into the House of Representatives to decide the winner. Under a peculiar system in which each state's delegation gets one vote, if Trump had succeeded in throwing the 2020 election to the House, he could have won a second term because 27 of the 50 House delegations have Republican majorities. To control the outcome in any one given state, one party has to be in control of both the legislature and the governorship. That makes the gubernatorial election in 2022 critical in the swing states like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. The otherwise obscure races for Secretary of State will matter as well. In Georgia, where Raffensperger refused Trump's request to find extra votes, the former squatter has already endorsed a challenger, the representative Jody Heiss, who has casted himself as a Trump sycophant, and they were trying to lay the groundwork for 2024 to make sure that local officials will jump if Trump tells them to. They didn't jump last time, but they might this time. Do Republicans really want to win a presidential election this way? Probably not. But any political party would rather have a clear and convincing majority without any need to resort to the chicanery. But Trump clearly has no such scruples, and his supporters and his sycophants, like the House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy of Bakersfield, he hopes to be Speaker of the House by 2024. Hopefully, fucking not. He basically has fallen in that line. McCarthy signed on to a pro-Trump lawsuit that asked the Supreme Court to invalidate Biden's electoral votes in four states. He was one of 126 GOP House members who voted against accepting the electoral votes from Arizona and Pennsylvania, which are two states that Biden won. When voters choose governors, legislators, and secretaries of state next year, they need to realize that there is far more at stake than what happens within the boundary of state lines. The outcome of the 2024 presidential election may be on the ballot, too.
Trying to basically look at something here.
Yeah. That will probably be all for right now to get to. I'll probably post another podcast, and I probably will post another podcast next week, because I'm due for my second COVID shot next week, and I'm also due for that interview with the next Meyer. So I'll probably do a podcast next week. If I get that job at the Highland Meijer, basically the door greeter position, it's pretty easy. So if I get that job at the Highland Meijer, I will probably post a video talking about it if I get it. Hopefully I do, because I want to get off a cart. And hopefully my information will be switched over there. But I gotta eat my dinner before it gets cold. I got fries, the beef tip, and the garlic bread. So I'm gonna go. And probably in the next week, I'll probably post another video, like another podcast episode. So hopefully you guys enjoyed.